Good afternoon and welcome to From Where We Are, stories of news and culture through the lens of USC and Southern California. I'm Lauren Hebroni coming to you live from Studio B in USC's Annenberg Media Center.
And I'm Taylor Brazil. It's Thursday, March 5th. On today's show, the fight against coronavirus continues, Congress passes an emergency spending bill to combat the virus, the Los Angeles Metrolink is increasing cleaning on their trains, and a local museum is preparing for a possible outbreak in Los Angeles. All that and more from where we are.
LA County has confirmed 4 more cases of COVID-19, also known as coronavirus. This increases the number of cases in the county to 11. This morning, Congress passed a bill to increase funding to prevent the spread of the illness. Jaewon Jung has more.
Today, Congress passed an $8.3 billion emergency spending bill to battle coronavirus. This is 3 times the amount Congress requested only last week. This shows the growing severity of the crisis. The bill is expected to provide $3 billion to research and develop vaccines and other treatments, $2 billion for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to help contain the virus, and more than $1 billion to fund overseas prevention. The bill passed in the House 415-2. It passed the Senate 96-1. The legislation will now head to the president. President Trump has stated he would sign any coronavirus package that Congress approves. Questions arise on what is the proper amount of funding to fight the coronavirus outbreak. Professor Ari Kaptein is executive director of the USC Dornsife Center for Economic and Social Research.
I don't think anyone knows really whether these are the right amount, but I think that's totally okay because you have to start somewhere, and as long as there is enough flexibility to respond to what's going to happen in the future.
The future in California is unclear. Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency soon after the first death in the state. Professor Kaptein agrees with that decision.
Yeah, I think uncertainty is a very good reason to declare a state of emergency. We may be at the very beginning of something big, but of course we don't know that either.
Many things remain mysterious about the coronavirus. That's why Congress needed to allocate such a large amount of money, says Professor Glenn Melnick. He directs USC's Center for Health Policy and Management.
There's 2 things that we still don't really know, which is how transmittable is this? Let's say I have the coronavirus and I interact with 10 people. How many of them are going to get it from me? Then the other big question is, out of every 100 people who get it, how many people are going to die?
Many of us have asked the very same question. We end up asking ourselves, what are the odds? For Annenberg Media, I'm Jaewon Jung.
Also this morning, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren suspended her presidential campaign. She had disappointing returns on Super Tuesday. What's next for Warren? Anisha Banerjee has some insight.
So I announced this morning that I am suspending my campaign for president. I say this with a deep sense of gratitude.
Outside her Cambridge home, Senator Elizabeth Warren officially called an end to becoming the first female president of the United States. This announcement comes after an underwhelming performance this Super Tuesday when she failed to win even one of the 14 available Democratic primaries.
She lost among college-educated voters. She lost among very liberal voters. She lost among women voters in Massachusetts.
That was Krishan Patel, a sophomore at USC, who identifies as a progressive Democrat. Warren ultimately failed to attract progressive voters over Senator Bernie Sanders. According to Professor Dora Vertentin of the USC Price School of Public Policy, this led to her failure to maintain momentum in her campaign.
You think about it as a track race, right? There's only so much space if you want to run on the inside. She always had Bernie running to her left. And he had a much larger support base for finances. So at some point, you run out of money.
During her speech this morning, Senator Warren did not endorse any Democratic candidates. For Seema Mehta, political reporter for the Los Angeles Times, this comes at no surprise for the 2-term senator.
you could almost see her going either way, because ideologically she and Bernie Sanders have a lot in common. But she's also more pragmatic, I think, in terms of trying to get her policies through than Bernie Sanders perhaps might be.
Even as the Democratic field narrows to a two-person race, it is unlikely that this will be the end of her political presence. As a former professor of law at Harvard, her knowledge of policymaking remains an attractive asset.
Certainly she'd be on anybody's vice presidential list of potential running mates. You know, she's an attorney. She could clearly serve several different positions, I think, in any Democrat's cabinet. And also, I mean, she's proven to be very, very popular, even if she didn't get the nomination. And I think, you know, she has a lot of opportunities in the Senate if she decides that she wants to pursue.
Though her bid for the presidency comes to a close, she probably has a plan for her political future. For Annenberg Media, I am Anisha Banerjee.
Early in the Democratic primary process, Elizabeth Warren had a following among college students. A poll published by College Reaction and Axios back in October showed her at the top of the field in the college demographic. More recently, she declined sharply, giving way to Sanders. Devin Kleiner spoke to USC students about their thoughts on Elizabeth Warren dropping out of the presidential race today.
I'd rather have no major woman candidates than just a bad candidate and just vote her in because she's a woman.
This time round, that the candidates probably weren't strong enough on that suit, but it is a shame to see such a male-dominated political race.
I think there will be a time when a woman is president, so just waiting for the right candidate to come along.
I'm from Massachusetts, so she's my girl. She's my home girl.
I mean, obviously, I would love to see a female in office. I feel like it's about time, and especially with our generation, it's going to happen.
That makes me really sad that she dropped out. I feel bad for anyone who drops out. They worked so hard.
She had not done well enough on Super Tuesday.
She had no chance, so, you know, it's not that she dropped out, she just didn't have a chance.
I honestly don't care. I haven't been paying attention to politics lately.
We heard from Kelly Moreau, Max Colson, Ava Brand, Cameron Brisky, Connor Christ, Aaron Cross, and Jason Winter. California has joined a handful of states in declaring a state of emergency due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Thomas Chow explains.
California Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency Wednesday evening, just hours after the state reported its first coronavirus-related death.
This is not something that I say hyperbolically and shouldn't be reported as such. It would be incredibly misleading. The proclamation is to serve to help advance our resources, to loosen up our regulatory environment, to provide some clarity in terms of jurisdiction and oversight capacity as it relates to the access and utilization of state properties.
California's first death brings the total toll in the United States to 11. The other 10 deaths have been in Washington state. The victim was an elderly adult with underlying health conditions from Placer County in Northern California. Officials believe they were exposed to the virus while on a Princess cruise ship last month. Newsom's speech addressed the ship, which has also been connected to another case of coronavirus. He says 21 people aboard the ship are showing symptoms of the novel coronavirus. Newsom has asked that the ship not return to California until testing is completed. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti announced a health emergency declaration on Wednesday. Garcetti and county officials assured the public that Los Angeles has been doing everything possible to be prepared. He also urged residents to be proactive in preventing the spread of the virus.
We have to be prepared. We have to protect the well-being of our loved ones and our neighbors. It's very important for us to also recognize that this isn't just something for government to do alone, but it's critically important in our workplaces, critically important in our households, that we each take responsibility for slowing the spread of what we know is now here and will be here.
More than 50 people across California have been sickened by the virus. NBC News reported Wednesday that an LAX medical screener tested positive this week for coronavirus. On Thursday afternoon, two cases of coronavirus were confirmed in San Francisco, but these patients had no history of international travel. For Annenberg Media, I'm Thomas Chow.
Since we reported that story, an 11th Washingtonian has died from the novel coronavirus. This latest death reported today brings the death toll in the United States to 12, one in California and 11 in Washington state. Hey, Lauren. Did you see the Blackboard message advising students against the traveling during spring break?
Yeah, the message said something about getting screened if I left the country, so I actually just canceled my travel plans to Dublin.
Yeah, no, I told my friend, too, that I refuse to travel anywhere if it's not by my car, because I'm just very terrified of anything happening. But sounds like you're not the only one canceling plans. USC officials are cautioning students against international travel over spring break, along with emails sent to the campus community that Blackboard message said students who travel abroad may be screened when they get back and could be isolated. Angie Shroud spoke to students about how the growing concern over the coronavirus outbreak has affected their travel plans.
I was going to travel to Italy to visit my family in May, and I'm not going to go anymore, but it sucks. I mean, my dad just came back from Italy, and he had to stay in the airport for like 11 hours. They had to analyze his itinerary and everything to see the cities that he's been. And then he was released after 11 hours. So I don't want to do that. And I'm taking summer classes, so I'm scared of being quarantined.
Me and my girlfriend were planning to go to Spain for spring break, and we are canceling the trip. Mostly the Blackboard blast, like, hey, you might have to go through a screening and isolation and, quarantine. Pretty deterring.
Yeah, I'm supposed to go on a trip to Cabo with all my friends, so... We're still going to happen so far, but we'll see in the next week or so what happens.
You just heard the voices of Gabrielle Gallo, Aaron Gallegos, and Grady Harrison.
Several major tourist attractions around the world have closed their doors as a response to the continuing threat of coronavirus. That includes theme parks like Disney's Asia locations and some museums in Europe and Asia. Lindsay Beister asked a museum spokesperson if that could happen here in L.A.
Los Angeles is home to many museums, three of which are just north of USC's campus. One of those museums is the California Science Center, or CSC. The CSC is a museum where visitors can explore different scientific exhibits through hands-on experiences for people of all ages. Just last week, the museum opened its latest exhibit, The Art of the Brick, the world's largest display of Lego art. Because the museum attracts a wide variety of people to its exhibits, it's important that the science museum stays clean and disease-free. That's something Shel Omega, the Senior Vice President of Communications for the Science Center, says the museum is staying on top of.
We have been receiving communications not only locally, but also from the state, and they advise that we remain open, but follow their guidelines regarding sanitation and hygiene. And so we've implemented those procedures.
Omega said the museum will continue to implement more health practices into the exhibits, which includes adding an extra sanitizing station to the Art of the Brick.
We have already in place daily sanitizing procedures and deep cleaning practices, and we'll be stepping those up in response to this.
The Art of the Brick sold out immediately after tickets were released to the public, so Omega hasn't seen any patterns of decreased attendance due to the virus.
We're looking at long-term responses in case there is a directive that comes down where we need to close part of the Science Center or all of it. You know, how are we going to continue to be resilient and implement telework and things like that? You know, so it is a possibility, but from what I hear, though, we're doing okay so far.
At the moment, the museum has no plans to close its doors, unlike some tourist attractions around the world, including the Louvre Museum in Paris. For Annenberg Media, I'm Lindsay Beister.
The Louvre was closed due to the coronavirus fears, but has since reopened. That's not the only place taking precautions. Metrolink, a commuter rail system in Southern California, announced that they are taking extra measures to disinfect trains in light of the spread of COVID-19. Officials say they have increased the number of cleaning staff and will be cleaning more frequently. But how much is enough?
I'm Lauren Hebroni. We're glad you're with us for From Where We Are.
And I'm Taylor Bazile. It's 14 minutes past the hour. Coming up, Super Tuesday voters experience long lines in California, USC Engelman Health Center to see patients using lottery system, and one reporter tells the story of how she came to the United States. long lines, broken machines, and frustrated people.
No, we're not talking about the waits at Disneyland. We're talking about the waits at the polls this Tuesday.
Did you get to any of the lines to vote, Lauren?
No, I actually mailed in my ballot. But as Sophia James reports, many Los Angeles voters experienced major delays at the polls on Tuesday. That includes delays at USC's voting center at the Grand Zero Cafe.
Tuesday's primary process in Los Angeles faced several technical errors, leading to long wait times and operational issues across the county's newly enacted voting centers. This year, LA County initiated a $300 million rehaul of their voting system. This included an elimination of the neighborhood polling places and the creation of vote centers with new computer voting systems. Additionally, the county set up early vote centers where voters could cast their ballots up to 11 days before the election. USC's on-campus vote center was not immune to the host of glitches experienced across the county. Voters on Tuesday reportedly have wait times of up to 2 hours at Ground Zero Performance Cafe.
That's the problem with check-in. The statewide system to check voters in and check voter registrations and do same-day registrations was overloaded by the amount of new vote centers, new voter registrations due to the change in the law allowing same-voter registration.
That's Ellie Viotto, a senior and co-president of VoteSC. VoteSC is a student organization committed to increasing voter education and turnout on campus. They help spearhead the initiative to bring a vote center to USC's campus. Brianna Miles, VoteSC's co-president, said the long lines were a result of more than just one technical issue.
Being on a college campus, there's a lot of provisional ballots that are inherently processed, and that takes a little bit longer as well. So these are all just systemic glitches that slowed down at the process, and that's what led to the long lines.
Most of the issues on campus were not due to glitches in the actual computer voting machines, rather the check-in and registration system, which was overwhelmed across the county. Miles noted how long wait times and confusions around voting can be negative for students, many of whom are first-time voters.
I mean, frankly, I think it's really discouraging. What I've always said is, with voting, especially for young people, it's maybe our first time or even our second time voting, and if you have a bad experience, you're less likely to come back. And this is the first time the system has been tested on such a large scale, from my understanding. So I think it's definitely a learning lesson. Once you figure out all the glitches, even just talking to the people from the county and the poll workers yesterday, they were saying there's a lot of things we learned from this.
The county plans to use the same voting system in November, though the myriad of technical issues experienced on Tuesday will likely lead to reforms to make sure voters can easily and securely cast their ballots. Viotto emphasized the importance of educating students on their voting options to ensure smooth sailing on election day.
But on our end, our vote center is going to be open for 11 days in the fall. You don't need to go vote on election day. You could vote a week out from election day. As a VoteSC team, we try to educate people and really push the early voting in November.
For Annenberg Media, I'm Sophia James.
In November, USC Student Health opened a new fifth floor clinic at the Engelman Health Center on campus. The new floor is intended to address student mental health concerns, but there may be a little turbulence. Gabriella Taglioni explains.
The fifth floor of the Engelman Student Health Center just opened last November, but currently there are more patients than the center can accommodate on campus. With only six practitioners available, that's a third of their desired staff. The clinic cannot accept all students seeking mental health services. Engelman is working to find the best system for accepting students. According to Dr. Steven Siegel, chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at USC, that system is a lottery.
We decided that we would try a system where all the therapists on the third floor submit the names every day for the patients that they believe need referral to the community. And at that point, we create a lottery of sorts, right? A random way of selecting which subset of people get referrals to the fifth floor versus which subset of people get referrals elsewhere.
Dr. Siegel says Engelman felt the lottery system was the most fair process for helping students now, but it's not a permanent situation.
It is a way to acknowledge that as we're building this new clinic, it simply lacks the full bandwidth that it will have eventually and that it will need. And between now and then, we need a way to do this that is fair, equitable, and provides everybody an equal chance at a referral. But once you have a referral, you get to see a doctor.
Engelman was built on campus to help students cope with a variety of issues without having to be referred to outside clinics. However, many students have concerns about the lottery system. Rachel Amig, a USC student majoring in interactive entertainment, has sought help at Engelman before but was encouraged to go elsewhere.
I guess I'd kind of understand if they're still getting it up off the ground and figuring it out and testing it out, but that seems like not the best solution.
Eric Huseman is a sophomore majoring in archaeology and geodesign, and he thinks the lottery system is unfair.
I mean, it makes it fair in that everyone has an equal chance, but some people need it more than others, so they should be prioritized.
Moving forward, Engelman is working toward hiring 12 additional practitioners. By having a full staff, Dr. Siegel believes they will be able to accept more patients and to improve the way they can help students. For Annenberg Media, I'm Gabriella Taglioni.
It's time for Match Volume. This week, we're featuring an interview with New York Times investigative reporter Brian Rosenthal. In this episode, Brian speaks with Felicia Tapia about getting started in investigative journalism. He says a single question can make or break a story. Let's listen in on their conversation.
Tell our listeners your title and what you do.
I am a Metro investigative reporter at the New York Times, which means I write investigative stories about New York.
So I want to go back. How did you first get into journalism? I know you did an undergrad.
My first step was the high school newspaper.
Okay.
Which I joined more or less on a whim. I really wanted to go to a good college. And I heard that if you want to go to a good college, you have to do a lot of extracurricular activities. So I joined every club in school, the debate club and the math ball team and the spelling bee team and the service organizations and the Boy Scouts. But I also joined the newspaper. And of all those things, I just loved working for the newspaper more than anything else. And I just developed a love for journalism there. And so when I went to college, got into a good college, I joined the college newspaper, and that was really what set me off was my experience at the college paper.
So what were some of the most fun things that you covered in those early years?
So, in terms of fun, I think the college newspaper experience was the most fun I've ever had, not only because of things I covered, although I can list a couple, but just the experience of being with your peers and the control that you had. I mean, I was the editor of the college paper, and I got to decide went in the paper and where it went. I'm never going to have that experience again. But I did get to cover a lot of cool stuff, too. I was there in 2008 and 2009 when Barack Obama was elected president, and I covered his acceptance speech, his victory speech at Grant Park for the paper. I created an investigations desk at the college paper, and we got into some real some real fun stuff, including we revealed the identities of every member of a secret society on campus, the campus secret society. We just printed them on the front page, which was awesome. Those are the ones that stand out.
It seems as if you kind of pursue these extreme questions, why does Texas have the lowest rate? Why is this subway line the most expensive construction? So do you think that asking these extremes are some of the most important part of investigative reporting?
Yes. Absolutely. I think it's really important when you're looking for a story to find out if there is an important question that needs to be answered. Why does anybody do a story, and especially an investigative story, except to bring information to the public, answer questions that maybe the public doesn't even know it should be asking? But that are really important to society. And I've found that if you can zero in on one question, it can make your job a lot easier because you kind of set that as the North Star and you can orient all of your reporting to it. In Texas, I talked to hundreds of people. And I think I asked every single one of those people the exact same question, which is, why do you think Texas has the lowest special ed rate of any state in the country. And why do you think there's been this dramatic reduction in recent years? Just as importantly, and you know, when you come at it from that type of a question, it you're not coming at it, you know, trying to prove a point or try and get somebody in trouble or be biased. You literally are trying to answer a question that's important, and I think it gives your work just a lot more credibility, and like I said, it makes it easier to orient what you're doing.
For the rest of this episode, check out Matt's Volume podcast on uscannenbergmedia.com or on Apple Podcasts.
Each year, more than 1 million immigrants from around the world come to the United States in pursuit of a better life. Lorena Bordevere from DeMello Radio tells us about her journey from her hometown in Jalisco, Mexico to the U.S. She made that trip 7 years ago. Now Lorena is a first-generation graduate student at USC Annenberg. She is also an editor for DeMello, Annenberg's Latinx media outlet. She tells her story.
For many people, moving to the United States represents one of the biggest life opportunities. The United States of America, the land of the free, the most powerful and rich place in the world. For me, moving to the United States represented uncertainty and the fact that I was going to be away from everything I love. The day arrived. My alarm sang at 5 a.m. and I woke up holding my covers like a little girl, scared of what was coming. Soon, I heard my mom's voice.
Lorena, ya estoy lista, ya nos tenemos que ir.
Sí, ya voy.
Lorena, are you ready? We have to go. I dressed as fast as I could and I checked my little suitcase one more time to make sure that I had everything I hold dear. I looked around my bedroom and closed the light, leaving behind what had been home my entire life. My family and I rushed to the bus stop and our 20-hour trip to the U.S.-Mexican border started. We arrived in Ciudad Juarez, where the immigration office is located, just some hours before our green card interview. The building was crowded. Hundreds of confused people looking around and asking questions, trying to understand what they had to do before having their interview. And then, it was our turn. But our interview ran smoothly, and our application was approved right away. With a bright smile, the immigration officer welcomed us to the U.S. "Bienvenidos a los Estados Unidos de America," he said, trying to speak Spanish. My stomach hurt. It was the first time I wanted someone to tell me, "Sorry, you can't come here." My mom, my two brothers and I walk out of the office. I nervously look at my dad and told him that everything had worked out well. My father's efforts had been worth it. The years he was away from us working to bring us to the US with him were worth it. We were walking to the unknown, but we were finally together. We walked through the border and I realized right away how different Mexico and the US were. From the crowded and narrow streets of Ciudad Juarez with hundreds of people rushing here and there, to the desolated city of El Paso with wide streets and fast food restaurants in almost every corner. I was finally in American land. It all felt unreal. Suddenly, I was on the other side, the country that so many people wanted to be in, but all I wanted to do was to run back to Mexico. Instead, another 17 hours bus trip from El Paso to Los Angeles was waiting for me. The start was very hard, but here I am now, 7 years later, amazed by all the opportunities this country has given me. Time has shown me that the things you are most scared of can become the things you love the most, and that the unknown, without a doubt, can also become home.
That's all we have time for on today's From Where We Are. Luke Scorzel, Ayana White, and Joshua Chang produced today's show. Evan Jacoby, producer, Yuki Lang, technical operator, and I'm Lauren Hebroni.
And I'm Taylor Brazil. From all of us at Annenberg Radio, wherever you are, we hope you'll join us again for
From Where We Are.